Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Dirtiest Podcast, number 305. I have Vegas voice right now because Skydart and I are in Las Vegas.
I have a name.
Clyde. We're at CES. Although, probably won't spend much time on the CES floor, because neither one of us want to get the nerd flu, because you always get sick when you go to CES. You cannot go to CES and not walk away with some sort of tropical flu or a cold that has Wi-Fi. But don't fucking groan at me. You're wearing a spirit hood. You groaning is like,
okay,
it's like having a wild animal just look disappointed at me in the woods. We're here at CES and, the Nerdist channel won, best channel at the IIW TV Awards, which was huge. We also, went to the New Media Expo, which was really fun. And, it's been really, really cool so far. Vegas, you can really only take for a day or two. Vegas is a lot like, I think I compared it last night to a gas station bathroom where you go in and you hold your breath long enough to pee. And then you try to pee before you let your breath out and get out of the bathroom so you can exhale. That's kind of what Vegas feels like to me. So like one or two days here is okay, but any longer and you start to want to pull your eyelashes out. But I would like to thank Amazon for being the sponsor of the Nerdist Podcast. If you go to this podcast page on the Nerdist.com website and just click through the Amazon banner and then shop as you normally would, you'll be supporting the Nerdist Podcast. Also, I will be performing in Bloomington, Indiana coming up like in the next week and a half. The 17th through the 19th, I believe, of January, and then after that in Tacoma, Washington, and then at Sketchfest. So go to Nerdist.com/calendar to get information about that. This episode is our longtime friend Anthony Jeselnik, who has a comedy special that is premiering this weekend, and also his TV series is premiering pretty shortly after that. So if you go to Comedy Central's website, then you can find out information about it. But known Anthony a long time, and really watched the evolution of his comedy career, and he super just kind of exploded after the Comedy Central roasts. And you know, Anthony's a good guy, and this is a really interesting episode because one of the big issues in comedy right now is what's offensive, what's not offensive, what's too soon, what's not too soon. You know, it's, I usually have sort of a broad, like, be offended by everything or be offended by nothing philosophy, but I know it's more complicated than that, and it's not that black and white. But, you know, I feel like this was an interesting conversation because a lot of Anthony's comedy comes from, you know, trying to expose and find humor in taboo topics or things that people, you know, that people might normally find offensive. But just seeing, he's sort of undertaken himself to see if there's a challenge in finding what's, if there is something cathartic and funny about stuff that might normally offend people. So it's a really interesting time for comedy through that lens. And so I'm interested to hear what you think about it from an intelligent standpoint. No trolling. So, you know, when you go to the Nerdist website and this episode, we've had several conversations on the site about it, but if you haven't, chime in and let us know what you think. And, you know, is everything off limits? Does comedy get a pass for everything, or does it not? You know, should it be more respectful? How do you pick and choose what's offensive and what's not offensive? And can you broaden it beyond just what you think is offensive? You know, like, because you could laugh at someone else's pain, but then be like, hey, that joke is about the region where I'm from, and I'm upset by that. You know, like, so I don't know. Let us know what you think on the website. But thanks for listening. And here's Anthony Jeselnik, the Nerdist Podcast, number 305.
I like my description of Las Vegas better. It's like cum covered Disneyland.
Disneyland?
Disneyland! That's awesome.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
But the shitty part is that we have to record onto these discs and then rip the discs. To put them on.
Rip it up! Rip the disc!
Okay, now we're recording.
Anthony Jeselnik has joined us in studio.
We're going a new direction with the podcast.
Yes.
I really like classical music radio.
Who doesn't?
It's just, there's a lot of weight to it and everything's very somber.
I always like to imagine those, like the DJs on classical music were the guys who used to be rock DJs but just got so burned out, like something happened to them. The man who go to class at the end.
Just like to, from like Wolfman Jack style 70s jock shock jock types. Yeah. And just like they take it down.
I can't do it anymore.
Yeah. You just heard Mozart.
Ow. Midnight Mozart madness.
Yeah.
Beethoven.
Who wants an etude? Are we still recording? Okay, good. We are. All right. Anthony, it's long overdue that we have had you on the podcast, so my apologies for that.
No, it's been too long. I'm to be here now when I have something to promote. I haven't done a podcast in a while, so it's...
I was going
to
say, what was the last podcast you did?
Actually, now, as soon as I said it, I realized I did Doug Loves Movies last week.
But God damn it!
Well, then that's
it. It's been a long time. You know, you do a bunch of them, and then you're like, all right, I've done the ones I want to do. And then it was always, I always want to do this one, and there's like two others I want to do, and then I think I'm done.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So this is the Anthony Jeselnik hello and farewell podcast tour that we're having. When I shot my pilot for Comedy Central, my offices were across the hall from where your offices were.
Now I'm in your office.
Oh, you're in those offices now.
The same office you used to have.
But there was a really funny picture where it said, you know, hardwired this way, and then Anthony Jeselnik's show and pointed an arrow in the other direction. And I took a picture and tweeted it to Jonah. I'm like, this is the hardest decision you've ever had.
Two friends that could give me work.
Which one? Where do I go?
Yeah.
Where do I go?
And the answer was neither.
Neither.
Neither. He stayed neutral.
Yeah.
He was Switzerland.
I never took either job, and now I need money badly. Not really. I'm doing really well.
Jonah Bing, Jonah Boom.
Hey.
What?
Well, I just don't like talking about it. I'd rather just think about it while watching my large television set.
Hey, I want to find Jonah's commercials online. Can you Jonah Bing that for me? Are they going to start calling it Jonah Bing?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. That's how successful I am to them.
That they...
Yeah. I'm going to see how much more disheveled I can get in the next one.
Are you doing more?
Yeah.
We were talking today about how Kyle Kinane is the voice of Comedy Central now.
Yeah.
Do you think he gets... I assume that they were like, this is a promotional thing, it's good for you. And then someone was like, he makes a ton of money for that.
I'm sure he does.
It's like every day. I mean, I'm sure they stack them, but like, it's throughout the day. Oh, like, coming up next is a new episode with this person, you know? Yeah.
And so even when
he's the new Penn Jillette.
Yeah, exactly.
Penn Jillette was the voice of Comedy Central for the longest time.
Yeah.
The big, only big movie. On Comedy Central.
Yeah, the big, yeah.
Revenge of the Nerds. Coming up next.
And then even like I was watching that channel and like Kyle's like coming up next is this thing, and then you can see me in Whiskey Icarus. So he like was able to refer to himself.
Mommy, oh, the wow. announcer's talking to me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's funny. I gotta see this announcer stand up. It's gonna be great.
How many times have you seen like an announcer and you've been like, oh, I really gotta
be. I bet he's hilarious.
But seriously, Don Pardo kills. Don Pardo fucking destroys when he does stand up.
When I first met Jimmy Pardo, I thought he was related to Don Pardo. This was a long time ago.
I want to put it past him.
Put it past him like it's something he's pulling over on everyone, not being related to?
No, that he would lie about it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Jimmy changed his name to get ahead in the business.
Yeah. He was doing pretty great as that announcer guy for SNL. How have you managed to avoid doing a podcast of your own? Well, you have a TV show.
Just the idea of having, like... The idea of having to book something and having to be in the same place once a week, and I didn't, just never had like a hook that I wanted to do. You know, I like podcasts like this. I love Marin's, you know, Pete Holmes.
Sure,
just like talk to comics, and you don't have to be funny. You can just kind of talk and be as pretentious as you want to get. But that's like what
I
would want to do.
That's just the prerequisite with a podcast.
Yeah, that's like what I would want to do, and not, you know, people have like their little themes and stuff they do that nothing's really grabbed me.
Yeah.
It's definitely been pitched to me that, oh, you got to do a podcast. I'm like, I've got... A TV show.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a podcast, but you can see it, and then a lot more of you can see it.
Yeah.
If it's a television.
It makes sense. People are like, oh, it helps on the road. It does this, it does that. I mean, you know what else helps on the road? Doing a roast. So.
Well, that helps you on the road. Like, the roasts help the handful of people who can, if you can crush in the roasts... That's tremendously helpful. And I loved, I think right before you did your first roast, I happened to be in New York and I saw you workshop those jokes at, Crash Test.
Whiplash.
Whiplash.
Yeah.
And it fucking destroyed. And I was like, God damn it. That's good. I was watching it like, his fucking life is going to change tomorrow. Like, it, just in the sense of, you know, it's so hard for comics now to get, like, that's why podcasts happen, was just comics getting their voice into the world as much as possible. There's not a lot of stand-up on TV anymore.
Yeah.
And so this way that we have to survive now is doing roasts, doing podcasts, just anything to let people know or about so they'll come see
us. Anything that's not stand-up that you can get out there to make people come see your stand-up is huge. But you're right about the roast thing. It's not like a guaranteed step up. Like, I remember when I would go back and watch, I thought it was the same way I thought that, like, Premium Blend, like, if I saw a comic on Premium Blend, I was like, oh, they made it.
Yeah.
And then before I went to do it, I like looked back through all the people who had done Premium Blend. I'm like, I've never heard of any of these people. Like, the roast, like, you watch old ones and it's like Reno Collier, and I'm like, who the hell? Like,
right,
I've never
right.
heard of him again since that it wasn't, I knew I had my work cut out for me.
Yeah. You
know, it wasn't just like a gimme.
Yeah. It was a handful of people, and the roast environment is, I hope people understand that it's not, it is kind of a weird set. Like, when you're shooting those shows, there's a ton, and I've never done, I'm afraid to do them, actually. I don't think I would do well, but when it works, it's great.
Well, I'm sure you wouldn't do well, but it is.
I got jazzle-nicked.
It's a very strange work environment, I'll say that, especially compared to between the comics and the celebrities. Everyone's got a different agenda of what they're doing, and they do not jive with each other, so it's a weird place to be doing jokes.
Yeah, because it's weird because the whole concept of roast is that you're supposed to be mean, but then there's that one weird cliff that if you just misstep and it's just like, oh,
yeah,
I don't, oh, shit.
Well, plus the person, I mean, if it's a really funny joke, even if it works that perfect line, when you're saying it to the person when they're sitting there, they're terrified. So that tension, like, when you deliver a joke, I remember asking Whitney Cummings this. I was like, well, do you look at the people? She's like, never. You look at them when you start the joke. I'll be like, Seth MacFarlane, you're... And then when you finish the joke, you look anywhere else but at that person.
That's so funny. It's like it's like the murderer who's like, okay, don't make me look at you. Exactly. I don't want to... Because I don't want to sense that you're a human being. Like, right now, I need you to be a one-dimensional character that I can...
Get in the corner.
That I can take shots at. Did you have any... Were you the one with the situation was at?
Yeah, I went on after the situation.
Is it better to follow him or go before him?
I mean, it turned out being better going after him, you know, but at the time, because on TV it looks way better than it actually was.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It was almost a riot. Like, it was really bad. And at first I'm kind of like, oh, this is weird. And then I realized, like, this could happen to me too. You know what I mean? And I've got to follow this. If the crowd doesn't get it together, and they're all so drunk. Comedy Central gives out every table pictures of beer and wine. Pictures of wine.
And there's also like a free drink time before the show even starts.
Yeah, people are so drunk that it took them 10 minutes to stop the show and get everybody to calm down.
You mean the audience
audience, yeah, before I could walk up there. And then I'm like, this better go really well really quickly or it could be a disaster. But as soon as they realized, oh, he's just doing setup punch and not rambling on about mansions and stuff, they were very on board.
I would think it would be better to go after him because even if you only have like a modicum of stand-up experience, the audience is going to be like, oh, thank God, you know. So if you actually go in with good jokes, I would think that the audience would be so on your side for that to happen.
Totally. But now it's almost backfired on me that Comedy Central, on the roast, they always put me after whoever they think is going to do the worst. Like, I'm like, can
save
I go
it
first, you know, or something? And they're like, no, we need to put you on after Mike Tyson because we're not sure how that's going to go.
Right.
So I got to sit there and wait to see what kind of puddle I got to clean up.
Was the situation, did he have any awareness of what was going on, or was it?
To his credit, I mean, he did not run off the stage.
Yeah.
Because that's what I would have, I mean, if the crowd turned on me that hard, you would just walk away. I think that wherever he goes, he gets booed. Mm-hmm. They're like, hey, they're doing a hot dog eating contest. We want you to show up. And everyone boos him. And then he walks off stage and gets a $10,000 check.
Yeah.
So he sat there and kind of did his thing and was telling his jokes. And to his credit, he got in like the day before. He was the last guy booked. And at that point, all the good jokes have been given to other people. Like, all the writers write for him. They had to explain how to say these jokes.
Ugh.
He wore sunglasses because Snoop wore sunglasses.
Sure.
Snoop can wear sunglasses.
Yeah. You know?
And the crowd was ready to hate him immediately. So it was bad. But I remember, I'll never forget him walking away from the podium towards all of us, you know, sitting there on the dais. And no one can look at him. We're all like, what do we say? We got to sit with him for the next hour. And he walks up in front of everybody and just stands there and gives us both two thumbs up and goes, that was good, right? And I'll never get Lisa Lampanelli being like, that was amazing. You were great. Sit down. He had no idea.
Yeah, none of those people have any awareness. That's why they're those people.
Exactly.
I mean, it's easy to like take shots at them and be like, they're dumb. They don't know. And then I don't know. In the past couple years, I've just gotten so much more empathetic to people, and just like everyone's just a people, and everyone's trying to, you know, like they didn't do anything wrong by taking that job. Like someone said, "Hey, you want to be on TV?" And of course, they kind of have that douchey energy that I would never hang around. But I don't know, like, but watching someone die a comedy death, I'm always gonna feel like, oh man, I am so sorry. Brutal. I just don't, because you know. You know that is our worst.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The worst I've ever felt, Jeff Ross just showed this to me. There was a clip from the, it's online, you can see it on YouTube, a clip from the Emmett Smith roast they did years ago on pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And there was a guy, I forget his name, he's a black comic, and Jamie Foxx introduces him.
Oh, I've seen that.
And he starts bombing really hard, and Jamie Foxx heckles him literally off the stage.
Yeah.
And he's trying to do anything he can to keep going with his material. It's a big break for him.
Oh.
And it is... like watching it, you can't help but empathize with him.
Yeah, well, it's the funniest I'd seen Jamie Foxx in a long time.
But I'll tell you something. I went to some party that Jamie Foxx was at the party, and Sarah Silverman was at the party. And Sarah, I don't know Jamie Foxx. I've never met him, but Sarah said that she had never met Jamie Foxx, but she went over to him, and obviously he knew who she was, and they talked for a minute. She was like, "I've always wanted to ask you about that roast," and he was like, he goes, people think that I was an asshole to that guy, but here's what you have to understand. They had all of the roasters backstage before, and Jamie Foxx was like, listen, this is going to be a tough crowd. You guys, you need to go out there. You need to focus. You need to bring your A material. Like, don't fuck around. And he said that guy was kind of like, yeah, whatever. Like, he sort of like just shrugged him off before, like really cocky. And so when he went out there and didn't do what he was sort of warned, you know, like that he should do, then I think Jamie Foxx just sort of felt like, well, I fucking told you, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was kind of so I think Jamie Foxx, even though everyone thinks Jamie Foxx is hilarious, I think he felt bad for looking like he threw the guy to the bus. But the backstage stuff was like, I fucking told you not to do what you did.
Yeah. Well, plus Ross told me right before that they cut it out of the actual thing that was pay-per-view. But there was some guy from the Cowboys came up to give a speech, and he wanted to be a sportscaster. So he had this long speech about how great the Cowboys are and everything. Went on way too long. The crowd totally turned against him. It wasn't no joke at all. And Jimmy Fox made fun, got up and like laughed about it, made fun of him. And as the guy's walking off stage, he takes his stool and he throws it at Jimmy Fox.
Oh.
Like on stage. So the tension was crazy. Like, it was, no one was in their right mind on that day.
That's how I want the Comedy Central roast to be. I want to see stools being thrown and a guy being heckled off.
It will happen. The way they're going, it will.
You think so?
It will happen. Oh, my
God. Weren't they going to try and class it up?
They tried, and they realized this isn't going to happen. Like, yeah, the Roseanne roast, they were like, please, some classier stuff. And I just said no.
Like,
I'm not going to go out like half-assed, because no one knows they're trying to make it classy. You know, if you bomb, it's you bombing up there.
Yeah, exactly.
Before I read these jokes, I just want everyone to know that we're trying to class it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't even going to wear a tie.
Yeah, exactly. Even those old ones, the old like Dean Martin roast, they weren't classy. They were just wearing suits. Yeah. They were just as surly and fucking raw.
But I think a lot of those roasts too, like those roasts were, from what I understand, they were staged a lot more than anyone than the general public would know. And that I had heard that a lot of the roasts were shot to an empty room.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. That it was just all like they just did close ups and they basically just it like that. You know, we all bought into the idea of like, it's all these friends in Vegas having a big crazy show in front of people. And it was actually just a produced television segment.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of it, they'd be like, here, tell this bad joke so that Dean can have this line to make fun of you. You know what I mean? It was a lot of, it was like teamwork. It was like a team putting on a show as opposed to every man for himself.
And then the ones where you would actually see an audience, like with the, like, they like, they'd point out a celebrity. They already have the guy lit and on camera to like cut to. The, what? No, you know.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, like 10 years ago, I saw the late night commercial for the celebrity roast. I'm like, oh my God, that was one of those things where you remember it as being the funniest thing that you had ever seen.
Yeah.
And then you watch them and you're like, what happened? What? Yeah. What happened?
Yeah. This is the episode I remember.
Yeah.
Every, these guys are all just jerking each other off. Why am I watching this?
Not jerking each other off. Not even just that, but a lot of the jokes, I mean, Rickles was funny, but a lot of the jokes were super racist. A lot of like, Red Fox is here. Someone's got to clean up after we're done. Like literally like that. And you're like, what the fuck? I don't remember this at all.
It's a simpler, more beautiful time, Chris.
No, Jonah.
What?
No, that's not good.
They were the greatest generation.
Except no one would roast Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
It was a lot of like...
Rickles? Rickles wouldn't go after
him? Well, Rickles went after him, but everyone else, it was a lot of like... Frank sure fucks a lot of girls, you know, like they were compliment roasting him.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that story that Rickles has about like he like takes these girls out to a restaurant and like he notices that Frank's there too. He's like, hey, Frank, would you mind like coming by the table to like say hi to make me look like really awesome in front of these girls? And he's like, I don't know, Don. And like he's like, no, please, just real quick, just do me this favor. I really like, you know, I want to impress these girls. Please just come by. And he's like, okay. So like, you know, he's like, well, wait like 20 minutes and then come by. So they're Rickles is having dinner with these girls. And then Frank comes by. He's like, hey, Don, how's it going? He's all, Frank, are you kidding me? Get out of here. I'm with these girls. So quit bugging me.
That's funny. I've never heard the oldest story in show business. Thanks for recapping it.
Uh-oh. Someone just out Jonah Ray. Jonah Ray.
No. Fuck you.
Well worth the wait.
You fucking dick.
This show has a new Matt Myra. His name is Jonah Ray. Day.
Some guy who fucking commented is like, yeah, we get it. You're from Hawaii. And I was like, you fucking record 4 or 5 hours of conversation a week. See how many times you repeat something from your stupid life.
Jonah comes unhinged. And another thing.
No, fuck. Like, I'm checked out for most of these things. It's the autopilot.
Well, your autopilot.
I wanted to drive all the way across town so I could talk to my friend that I see all the time for like an hour?
Both of us.
Yes. Two guys.
That you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that reminds me. Thanks for having me.
Visibly uncomfortable.
It was a shitty drive. And I had no coffee today.
What? Oh. You had to drive all the way over here and you haven't had coffee? No one has worse problems than you, Jonah Ray.
You're Chris. What? I've seen you scream at a person for not getting your chai latte right.
That's not true. I screamed at a person because they ran out of a croissant that had ham and cheese baked inside. That's a big difference.
That's different.
I came all the way from Los Angeles for this.
Yeah. 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 What's the problem? Ken's Artisan Bakery in Portland has the best fucking baked ham and cheese croissant things.
Croissant.
Croissant.
Mm.
And I didn't yell. I was just terse.
This would be a great time to promote a new special, January 13th on Comedy Central, Sunday night against the Golden Globes.
Oh, fuck. Good counter programming.
I guess. I was furious.
Why would they put it on a Sunday?
Sometimes they do Sundays. They do Sunday. I think Sunday's better than Saturday.
I guess that's true because people are home.
But I did it like 6 months ago and they're like, we're going to hold it for the perfect time. And then I found out like 2 weeks ago it was during the Golden Globes. I was like, what? The fourth highest rated television show of the year? But
that's a bummer.
Yeah,
they're counter programming. I feel like the people who like you probably won't watch the Gold. I mean, like, you're not the same audience as the Golden Globes.
No, I wish it wasn't Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. That would be something that I would want to watch.
Oh yeah, that's a problem.
So many comedians live tweet the Golden Globes, that kind of stuff. That I was certainly annoyed, and I let people know that was my ham and cheese croissant moment.
Yeah. Thing is, there's no other real like show. All the shows are kind of done for the season, so that's the only other option.
Yeah,
like as a Golden Globes, and people could easily watch the Golden Globes and then just DVR yours and watch it right after.
DVR, it's so weird to me. I'm just noticing now that DVR isn't like as good, isn't nearly as good. It almost doesn't count if people DVR as opposed to watch it because they're not looking at the advertising.
Yeah, they have difficulty. They have difficulty translating those numbers to advertisers. They're like, oh, a bunch of people watch this while skipping through your ads. Exactly. Like they don't like to.
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
They're trying to create some sort of a metric that figures that in, but it's hard because it, you know, to the advertisers, they just feel like, well, they didn't see any of our spots.
Yeah, and Comedy Central's weird too, where if you get big ratings your first airing, they air it forever. If you don't do that well your first airing, then they just like shut it down. They're like, oh, we made a mistake, kind of thing. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
like, you don't know what you're up against. You don't know what you're. You know, what reason you could possibly have for not having high ratings, but it's a weird position to be in.
When does your show premiere?
February 19th.
Okay, so special in January and then the show in February.
Yeah.
Well, what'll end up happening is, because it's not even one airing anymore.
No.
And they'll, especially if you have a series to promote, they'll air your special more and they'll air it around your show. And I think it'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm not. I was mad at the time, but I've
you've gotten over it?
I've become.
I'm still mad about the ham and cheese croissant. I'm going back to Portland. I fucking hope they have it.
They better have it.
They fucking better have it.
There are going to be some angry tweets.
They're going to get such a tweeting. The first time that you have that feeling when you're like, well, I'm just going to tweet this. And you're like, what am I saying? Like, it's a bad feeling.
Yeah.
It's a really bad feeling.
Anthony, you only really tweet when someone dies.
Someone dies or a tragedy.
Yeah.
I had to hold off on this last one. I was ticked.
I was ticked. Onion was killing it.
Onion's great. Onion can get away with anything.
Yeah.
I think it's the aesthetics of it. It's the way it looks. Like they don't. Yeah. It's not really like a hard joke.
And it always seems way more compassionate in some odd way.
Yeah. Well, it is compassionate because it's ultimately like the one that the first time they came back after 9/11, it was something to the effect of America just wants to get back to having shitty problems again or something like that.
Well, I remember the first, like the day after, it was like, holy fucking shit. And it was just like a picture of the towers was just, that was the whole headline.
Yeah.
Holy fucking shit. That like, you can get behind that, but as if you do like a one-liner, it's got to be perfect. Like I wake up in the morning sometimes and I have like 100 tweets. People saying, what are you going to say? And I'm like, what happened? Who died? And so I have to like decide right then and there if I'm going to do something. It's got to be good enough.
Well, how do you, because there's definitely a vibe in comedy now where I think a lot of comics are afraid to go certain places about things because something will get taken out of context and put online and then all of a sudden people get mad about it and then you have to defend yourself. Like, do you, you probably don't give a shit about that, do you? Because you just sort of feel like it's comedy and this is what I do.
Yeah, and
I
that's really... kind of, that was my thesis, when I started. I was like, if I become that guy who does this, you can never really get in trouble.
No, because it's like South Park, because
yes.
It's like, well, that's what the show is. And they're, and weirdly,
It's weirdly equitable in the sense that they just make fun of everyone.
Everyone.
So there's no real ist behind it. They're not racist or culturist or elitist. It's like they just take everyone out equally.
Exactly. Exactly. And I feel like I've kind of gotten to that point where I can kind of get away with that for the most part, which is a pretty good place to be. And I don't understand. I feel like comedy is like that's the purpose of comedy. So when someone's like, "I'm afraid," like, "Oh, the rape joke thing with Tosh happened," people are like, "I don't want to comment on it," or "I think Tosh shouldn't have said that." I was like, "You're not really a comedian. If you can't back him 100%,
yeah,
for making a joke like that, then I lost respect for a few friends,
really,
who went against Tosh on that. It seemed like you're going against comedy.
It's weird too. And he was wasn't he riffing, yeah, at the time. Like it was still just like him trying to get into an idea. And he mentioned it, and then someone got offended.
Yeah, I did an interview about it the other day, and this girl was like, "Well, what do you think it's okay for him to say, oh, I hope you get raped right now by five guys?" And I'm like, that's not what he said.
Yeah.
You know, that's besides the point. Like, of course that's not okay. It depends on, you know, the context of anything. You can't say, oh, this is never okay to talk about.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the slippery slope, is that when things take on a life of their own because they get pulled out of context, and then someone says, oh, you think it's okay to say this, just like you said, you go, well, number one, I didn't say that. And number two, you weren't there and you didn't see what happened. Yeah. And yet you're trying to critique it in some way. It's like, I think, you know, however you feel about what he said or how it happened, like the point is there's so much judgment in our culture where people have not actually experienced the thing that they're judging.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it gets really dangerous because, again, you know, like we're culturally addicted to outrage.
Yeah, and you never know when it's going to blow up. You know, like Amy Schumer had it when she did the roast and made a joke about Steve-O. That kind of, and it was like during the roast, no one thought that was a particularly bad joke about Ryan Dunn, who had died. No one thought it was like, no one was like, ooh, it was just like, it was a roast joke.
Yeah.
They aired it, no one thought anything weird, and all of a sudden you just start to see all this outrage with Gilbert Gottfried. Gilbert Gottfried sat down with Amy and talked to her about it afterwards. He was like, you never know when they're going to turn on you. You know, those tsunami tweets were nothing. They were nothing, and he almost ruined his career, or definitely took him off the tracks for a couple of years.
Yeah,
he had to go on a book tour right when that happened, and every place he went, he had to read this book. There were like three people there, and they were all there to yell at him about the tsunami.
But I think that's sort of the. I think, you know, I mean, maybe, but particularly in Gilbert's case, though, I just feel like, well, you know, that's the risk you take when you go after stuff like that. Like, because he did that. He did that at that one roast right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Like right after 9/11.
Yeah,
and. You know, it's like, well, you never know when people are going to turn on you, but it's also like, well, don't go into a bad neighborhood right away, and then maybe I don't know, I guess it just depends on...
Sure, I mean, it's weird to see what's going to end up, you know, trending on Twitter. You never really know. And I always think of, like, Nick DiPaolo. I remember after the earthquake in Haiti, one on stage was making jokes about it right, like, the day of, and people got mad at him. He screams at them, he goes, what are you mad about? In 3 weeks, you'll be laughing at these jokes, and those people will be just as dead as they are right now. And I was like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And no matter how bad something blows up, 6 months later, no one cares. No one still thinks about Tracy Morgan as the guy who made, you know, a homophobic rant at that show.
Yeah.
You know?
It's just, it's important for people to just kind of realize they are jokes. And like there's really no need to get upset. It's, you know, like, why do you need the time?
Sure. People want an apology. It makes it about them. But I think there's some comics who, if you're up there and you're talking about, you're making jokes about like the neighborhood you grew up in, or you're making fun of Starbucks, and all of a sudden you're like, and rape's okay. That's when people get outraged because you're trying to be their friend on stage. I'm never trying to be your friend.
Yeah.
I could not care less about my audience, that I'm just up there strictly to satisfy myself, that I think people get that.
I just, you know, when I was a younger comic, I used to like the, you know, the shock and offensive, like I'm going to do, you know. And then I'm too much, and, you know, maybe I'm a pussy, or I don't know what, and it's not that I'm a pussy. I'm super empathetic of people. And so if I never want people to feel bad. And so I just stopped doing all of that because I just felt like, well, I don't feel good about it, and they don't feel good about it. And I just, like, if someone tweets at me and says, or they write to me and they go, hey, it really bummed me out that you did this. It's very hard for me to be like, well, fuck you. You know, I'm always like, shit, I'm sorry. You know, it's like, I just don't want it. But I still think that you can do material that's challenging. It's just super personal, as opposed to like what you said versus
you know, just going up and making jokes about some unrelated thing just to try to be funny.
Sure, and I think that's totally okay. Like, you know, if you... I think Stephen Colbert once said that when you're younger, you start out and you're very edgy because you want to be edgy. And then the things you're joking about starts to happen to people that you love and the people that you know.
Yeah.
People start to die from cancer or have these horrible things happen that they're not, that's not funny to you anymore. And I totally understand that. Or if your personal choice is, I just don't want to upset someone. I don't want to see an angry face in the audience. That doesn't make you a worse comic or change, you know, or change anything about it. You're still a comedian. It's just like you're bringing yourself to it. You know, whereas I have almost no conscience whatsoever,
But that's who you are. Like that's who you portray on stage, and so that's that part of it works for you because it's organic and it's not like there's a different. You can tell, and it's not just about the kind of material you do, but just you can tell when someone's doing material that's not who they are, and they're trying to affect a persona. And I think the audience can understand, like, ah, there's a disconnect. But if it really is an organic piece of who you are and it seems natural and it's your character, then it connects more and people understand it.
Yeah, it just clicks with them. Like, oh, I know what you are and I can get on board.
I feel bad because we have this conversation a lot. We've had this conversation a lot on the podcast where I, you know, my general thing about comedy is like, look, the core of... the core of almost all comedy is offensive to someone because comedy is really about trying to deal with horrible things and gaining power over those things by trying to ridicule or laugh in the face of those horrible things. And so, you know, when people go, well, how could you talk about this one thing? And it's like, well, but you laughed at the other thing, which would have been offensive to someone else. So
exactly.
What I try to say to people is like, look, when it comes to comedy, and I don't think comedy is for everyone.
No.
But when it comes to comedy, I say you kind of got to have this be offended by everything or nothing sort of thing, because it's not fair to pick and choose what's okay to be offended by, you know.
But no one knows that comedy's not for them. Everyone thinks they have a great sense of humor. Most people do not. But everyone enjoys laughing.
Of course.
It's like if you were a big music fan and you would just spend all day, you loved classical music, so you would spend all day writing angry letters to heavy metal bands.
Yeah.
It would be insane to do that.
Yeah.
But people don't care about it in the music that way. But in comedy, it's never like, I don't think you're funny. It's always, you are not funny. Here's why. I'm going to tell you why.
Right.
This thing you've dedicated your life and your career to. Me, just some random-ass gas station attendant, is going to tell you why that's not funny. And you get it constantly.
Mm. And it's like, oh, so we just have difference of opinion on how...
No, no one's doing
how comedy works. But I just don't think that... I wish just people... I think it has a lot to do... If someone feels like you're attacking some, because it's like what Mel Brooks said about, well, comedy is protest. And so you're trying to take something down, and the audience kind of has this barometer of like, does that thing he's taking down deserve to be taken down? Yeah. Where's the balance of power? And so I think in some cases they sort of feel like, oh, well, you're kicking something that's already down. So why would you? That's wrong. That's injustice. Like there's like a weird justice thing.
Yeah. Or like I think every joke has a victim. And if you relate more to the victim than you do to the person telling the joke, then you're not going to like that joke. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I still, you know, and it's impossible to defend when someone says, so you think it's funny to make fun of, you know, like a baby who drowned. I'm like, no, I don't. It's not that.
Yeah, that's not funny. You don't go up on stage and say talk about things that are funny. You talk about things that aren't funny and make them funny. Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's wordplay.
Yeah.
At the end of the...
Which is why I like Bill Burr so much. It's because a lot of the stuff he'll bring up, I don't necessarily agree with. But then what he does is he kind of convinces you with jokes and humor.
He's a great comic. You're fucking right.
You're completely right.
He's one of the best comics that way because Bill can take you to places and then pull you back.
Yeah.
And like he really fucking shakes the audience up. But you do that too. I mean, like you're I'm sure a lot of people laugh at stuff that you say and they kind of go, I shouldn't be laughing at this and I can't help it.
Oh, it's the best laugh. It's the best laugh. I always like when Louis C.K. he had a joke where he's mad at some woman in line, so he's like, so I've raped your kid. Like the kid's crying, so I raped the kid, and people are like, ooh, and he goes, fuck you, it's fucking make-believe. I made that kid up. I'll fuck an invisible kid right here on stage. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, you're right. And they can move on with everything.
Yeah. It's not real.
Yeah.
Not real.
Yeah, like, I think it's meaner when a comedian goes on stage, like when Kathy Griffin goes up and makes fun of what Mariah Carey wore to an award show, is meaner than anything I do. Everything, every joke I say, even though it's these horrible topics, they're all made up. They're all people who don't exist. But to make fun of someone who actually is like a person, I think is meaner, but no one sees it that way.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point of view. I never thought of that before. I guess that is true. I've come to just, you know, like when I first started, I think I'm just kind of weirdly insecure, and I don't like it when people are mad at me. I can't take it. I just want everyone to be happy, which maybe is a flaw. But I, you know, when I first started doing Chelsea's show, I would, you know, I'd go on and I'd make fun of celebrities that I didn't know, and I would leave feeling really bad. And I asked Whitney Cummings about it, and she gave me the best piece of advice in the world, which was, she was like, look, if you don't want to go after people, take the topic and then just make it about yourself. Well, that's like how this one time when I did this, and then I was like, oh my God, that's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a brilliant way to do it. And it sort of helps you address things that are going on without feeling like you're attacking other things, or just kind of going in.
I do that a lot on the roast. If I don't really want to make fun of someone, I just make like an edgy joke that's not at all about them. You know, like my joke about who's the woman from Sons of Anarchy, Married with Children.
Katie Sagal.
I was like, I don't want to make fun of her. You know, and everyone's doing this like you're old now jokes or whatever. And I just made it like took her and made a joke about like basically John Ritter is dead. Like, that was the punchline pretty much, but it had nothing to do with her. But it's still a hard joke, you know, which is a fun way to go about it. Because you don't want to make fun of some, you know, 50, 60 year old woman. You know, it's just a weird thing. So you've got to find a way to make a hard joke without making fun of them at all.
What was your comedy development? Like, for the longest time, there were, not, like in the late 90s, there weren't as many like quick turn, like two line joke comics. Mm-hmm. And then,
early
2000s, it, like there was a handful of like, BJ Novak and Morgan, yeah, and
Dan Mintz.
And Mintz. And then, there seemed to be this, and I think a lot of it, well, it was Zach.
Yeah. But Zach hadn't broken. Everyone knew who Zach was in comedy, but other than that, not really.
So what, you know, did you ever experiment with another style, any other style?
Oh, yeah. When I started, I took a class to start. I originally just wanted to be a joke writer. I wanted to write for basically the job I ended up getting, which was Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. I wanted to be on a late night show and just write monologue jokes all day, laughing at a table with other people. And I didn't realize how little you laugh when you're writing jokes at a table with other people.
When there's a tremendous amount of pressure to have to come up with like 20 jokes a night.
Exactly.
And you felt that way for a while too, like you wanted to be a writer. I mean, even years in, you would still bring it up.
Yeah, I just thought, I didn't think being a comedian was like a realistic thing you could be, you know, but a joke writer sounded like something, oh, I could do that. And so someone was like, oh, get into stand-up, that'll help you. So I took a class, and they were like, just talk about yourself. You know, just talk about yourself. So I had a couple stories I would get up on stage and tell, and I hated it. I was really bored. I thought I was boring. I thought it was really self-indulgent to talk about myself. And then I saw BJ Novak one night at an open mic and just doing one-liners. And I was like, oh, like I always loved Stephen Wright. I loved Mitch Hedberg, you know, and I found out about him much later on. But then I was like, oh, I kind of tore everything down, and I was like, I'm going to start from scratch and find out what I would really love to do. And I thought, what's the funniest thing in the world to me? What made me laugh the hardest? And for me, it was Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy on Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. Those were the most amazing things to me because it was so funny, and it was also this, how did he think of it? So I just bought all the books. There's like five of them.
Yeah, those are good books.
And I would go to open mics a couple hours early, and I would read through them, and I would write my own versions of that. So I would, and it was fun for me because instead of having to think back into my life and be like, what story could I tell? Or what adventure can I get into? You know, I didn't want to complain about my girlfriend or something. That I thought, oh, if I could just write jokes, I could write a million jokes.
Yeah.
And then just take the best ones. I thought, like, what if you were just like a total home run hitter and every joke was just crushed? What would that be like? Let me try to do that. And so I just wrote jokes. And then one night after maybe 6 months of doing that, of being a one-liner guy, and they were all kind of absurd, I told one that was really mean, that had a mean twist. And the crowd kind of went, oh, and then laughed, like harder than I've ever heard a laugh before. And I thought, that's it. That's my thing. Like, I was so lucky to find that less than 2 years in. And then I just kind of, I felt like I was a train on the tracks. Just keep moving forward, keep shoveling coal in there, and you're good.
Oh, well, that's it. Yeah. I mean, I think very few people think to ask those kinds of questions when they start out because they're very important questions because most people just start doing comedy and they don't even think like, well, what do I want to do? Well, I guess I just want to be funny. And it's like,
yeah.
You know, I think it's like saying, well, I want to I want to be a house decorator, but I don't have a house. And I just need there to be a house. It's like you have to figure out what your structure is. So having deep thoughts, as even as a structure, is a good place to start from, because most people don't even find their structure for years. They just have to figure it out over time.
Yeah. And I think everybody, almost everybody pretty much, takes their favorite comic and they you know, kind of copy them for at least a year. You've got that grace period. Like I recently watched my first ever stand-up that I ever did at the Comedy Store. And at the time I thought it was great. And I went back and watched it. And I was like, oh my God, this is horrible. And I can't believe the heavy, heavy Dennis Leary influence that was on me at that time.
So ultimately the Bill Hicks influence.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, you're still wearing the leather jackets. So.
Oh, yeah. I remember I used to open mics in L.A. and I had like a leather blazer that I would bring, and it would be hot out, so I would carry it with me. And right before I went on stage, I would throw on the leather blazer and go up and do my act.
Oh, wow.
That's what you did. I thought that's how you do comedy. And then someone mentioned it to me one time. I was like, oh, yeah, that is not cool.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went to the Comedy Store, and I was like in the back hallway by the bathrooms in the kitchen, and I was just like, every comic in here is wearing a black leather jacket. And I felt like, I was like, I don't feel good here. It felt like a bunch of fucking like jocks hanging out, and I didn't feel like I fit in.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, I think the thing that helped me was that I picked Jack Handy as the guy I was ripping off. That no one really. Some people, if you watch a lot of SNL, you'd be like, oh, you're like Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy. But most people, it wasn't like people who like totally misfortunate people who try to do a Hedberg up there. Never. You know exactly what's happening, and no one's ever.
Well, it's like trying to do Steve Martin. It's like, you know. There's a difference between trying to emulate the style of someone and then just flat out doing an imitation of them. Like you cannot do a Mitch Hedberg imitation or a Steve Martin imitation. It's like those characters were so strong.
Yeah.
That it's just too, you know, they're impossible to, it's like, I feel like people like Maria Bamford, you can't copy them because it's just so much, their character is so much of who they are on stage. God damn it. So, but you cannot steal a joke from Maria Bamford.
Yeah.
No. You cannot steal it. You like, which I always think, like, that means she's a really great comic.
Yeah.
I remember someone telling me that, we're hearing this, I'm sure it's, you guys have heard it too, that that Richard Pryor ruined a generation of comedians. Because a whole generation tried to be like him, and they couldn't do it. So, like, all these people who could have been good if they had gone some other way, he ruined them. And I kind of, when someone tells me, oh, I saw this guy at an open mic doing an impression of you, basically, for 5 minutes, I always think, great. That's great. Good luck with that kid. But I'm always flattered. I think it's awesome.
But, I, you know, it's the way that people do the impression. If they looked at Richard Pryor and said, okay, they think what Richard Pryor is doing is... you know, is more about the content rather than the delivery system.
I think it was the openness of Richard Pryor.
That's what makes Richard Pryor. It's like, what makes Richard Pryor is that he can tell these really honest stories on stage and just sort of be an open book on stage and make it really funny. That's what you want to emulate, not the stories that he told or the language that he used. Like, that's not what you emulate. You emulate the structure of what he was doing, and then you fill it in with your own content, your own meat.
Exactly.
It's funny. It's funny for me because I feel like I was influenced. Well, because I tried Steve Martin for my first, which was impossible, totally impossible. And then early Dennis Miller before he got kind of weird.
Before 9/11, yeah.
Like the black and white special. I think the Dennis Miller black and white special is one of the best comedy specials ever. He hadn't gotten crazy, like preachy yet.
And it didn't go, it wasn't, like there was a rhythm there, but it hadn't gotten like become a parody of itself, which it did.
I found out Dennis Miller, for the black and white special, he shot that on 35mm, paid for it himself, and was just like, no one would do this to me. He just was like, I need to make this amazing, and did everything himself.
Shit.
And did that, it must have cost a fortune.
Yeah.
Especially back then, I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was try to emulate that for a little while and then couldn't do it. And then I feel like I was heavily influenced by people like Dana Gould, where I'm like, oh, my God, you know, you can write eloquently filthy material that is, you know, that is dark and weird, but not necessarily gratuitous, but still, you know. So I feel like it's weird to be influenced by someone who's your friends with.
Yeah.
But I was. I feel like I was.
Yeah. I don't know how many people, besides the BJ Novak thing, and I would love to watch Dan Mintz. Like, Mintz is one of the only guys who I'd be like, oh, I wish I had that joke.
Yeah.
But I looked more at musicians for how to act on stage, kind of. Like, I thought about like Jack White a lot. Like, Jack White just goes up, he's got a shitty drummer, and he just walks out there with a guitar and just blows everything off the stage. That if you just had that kind of confidence and that cockiness to you, and you kind of wanted that in a guitar player, you know, you don't want to be a humble guitar player.
Yeah.
You want the cockiest guy in the world. That what if you were just that guy and just brought that to stand up, which I don't think a lot of people had.
And I was your shitty drummer in Casa Brat Pizza.
I remember saying that to you once, and you got so mad at me. Joan and I used to go on stage together a couple times and do this thing called Casa Brat Pizza.
It was a way to hang out and drink.
And we did a bit once, and we were like talking about how awesome it was. And I was like, yeah, you're like my Meg White. And you were just like, dude, that's the worst thing. I was like, all right.
That's not cool at all.
Yeah, hey, come on, man. For a podcast.
You crossed the line. Are you guys? You did a bunch of shows together on the road, right?
We did Brea and we did San Jose. San Jose, not a good city.
What? Not a good city for comedy?
Those shows were fine.
The shows were bad. Part. It was just like we'd walk around the neighborhood during the day to try to find something to eat, and it was like every restaurant was closed.
Boarded
it
up.
Either boarded
go
up.
Go away.
Or it should be open, and it wasn't.
There was a thing where it's we were asking the manager. Like the shows were done, and we're like, "Hey, like, where should we like go get a drink after this?" And he's like, the guy's like, "Wherever you go, just don't go right."
Yeah. Oh. If you take a right, you're gonna get shot. If you take a left, there's a bunch of stuff to do.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is the worst.
Like, buy guns. Yeah. And then body armor.
Yeah.
And then don't get shot.
But his shows are really fun. Like it's a good audience, except for that one time where it was like 50 octogenarian ladies.
What was that?
It was in San Jose.
The one I got mad at was, I remember we did this show where the whole like first like six rows was bought out by a company that was having their company party, and it was they made missiles
for
the military, and they were such dicks, and I like hated them. I felt like I was doing a corporate gig with like fans of mine in the back. I was like so mad, and I walked off stage and I was like, I've never been so pissed on stage. I can't believe I just did that show for them. I wish I had left 20 minutes in and been like, fuck you all. And Jonah said, you cannot tell the difference between you feeling that way and when you're having a great time. Yeah. Like, it was both the exact same character.
So do you think you're a dick, or do you think like, no, this is just a character that I do on stage, or is this a part of who you are? Like, is it a part that you wish you had explored in real life that you're getting out on stage, or is it just a character?
I think it's a character. I just think it's funny to be a dick. And like, if I'm being a dick, it's to be funny.
Yeah.
You know, but I just think it's so funny that you have to commit to it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have everything's got to be like, I couldn't talk about, you know, I couldn't really tell a story about my life and be real and sincere and have jokes in it and then tell these one-liners.
Right.
I had to basically be the devil.
Yes.
And I was able to pull it off.
Well, and that's and I think that's, it's such an interesting mechanism of comedy where an audience, what they want you, they come in and they pay you to not just be funny, but to lead them emotionally somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you seem competent, then they'll be like, all right, I guess it's okay, you know? So if you, as long as they know the rules, you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah. I learned very quickly that you couldn't, like, if you tell a joke that doesn't work, you can't be like, oh, that didn't go very well.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that.
No.
You know, that everything fell apart.
Hey, you're right!
So I had to go the opposite way and be like, you guys didn't get that joke? That's a great joke. And then go on to the next one.
This
joke is fantastic.
Yeah, I think that was the turn I saw, because your jokes were always really good. But it was the kind of the problem that, you know, Mintz ran into, which was just, it was just these jokes, these like singular pieces of comedy. And that you kind of just like, you don't know how long you are into the set. There's no real flow to us. It's kind of staccato thing. But you started doing that stuff where it was just like, you know, treating the audience like shit and like tell them they didn't get it. They're not smart enough. Like, these are great jokes, you know. And then all of a sudden you had this, that kind of connected the jokes, the character, and the set. Like, everything actually kind of connected.
Started to weave everything through the character. All the jokes came from a character, as opposed to, I'm just telling you these clever thoughts.
Yeah,
you
know, and the in-between stuff is really what, like, I remember, like, when I saw you do that at the M-Bar, I was like, oh, it's solidified.
Yeah, I always hate that comment. People will be like, oh, you know, your jokes are good, but I love the stuff you do in between. Like, when you smile in between jokes, I'm like, you know how hard I worked on these fucking jokes?
Two-line jokes are rough, too, because they're hit or miss.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot, you know, at least if you're telling a longer story, you can distract people with adjectives or, like, you know, or whatever. You can misdirect a little bit.
Yeah.
But if you're, you know, like, those jokes pretty much live or die by the joke and how you sell it, and that's it.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Jack Handy line?
My favorite one, I think, would have to be the, I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, but the I'm Afraid of Clowns. I don't know why that is. Maybe maybe it comes from the time my dad took me to this. I went to the circus and a clown killed my father.
Yeah,
I was like, holy hell, when I heard that. Yeah, I was totally blown away.
There was a Modern Family joke that was like really similar to that, and really? I had to rewind it, and like it was just pretty much. It's like the dad was like, Ty Burrell was just like, it's like talking to the camera. It's like. I'm not afraid of clowns. I mean, it seems like I would because I found one dead in the forest once when I was a kid, but I'm not afraid of them.
Yeah.
But my favorite Jack Handy one is just, it's so dumb. It's the, if I'm ever falling off of a building, I'm going to get real stiff like a mannequin because someone might try to catch me because, hey, free mannequin.
Yeah. I like the one that was the... I don't even remember the body of it. It was just it was about their uncle, like he had an uncle caveman and he was unshaven a lot. And occasionally he'd eat one of us. Yeah. Later we found out he was a bear. It's like fucking.
That was great. And one of my other favorites was I think it's a good idea to carry around two sacks all the time. So if someone asks you to help with something, you can say, sorry, got these sacks. But I noticed when I started kind of imitating him that if you just went and read those, he had maybe 20% that would have gotten a laugh on stage.
Right. Yeah.
The rest of them were funny to read. You know, I'll write a lot of jokes like this looks funny on paper, but if you say it, it doesn't have enough tension. It doesn't have enough of
the context of them were perfect. You're going to commercial, you don't expect it. It's really quick, and then they move on, and then it doesn't linger.
And that's why they were funnier than Fuzzy Memories, which was when he came back to do segments like that, which were very similar, but they were more like reenactment type of things. Yeah. And they just, for some reason, just the reading the text on screen, and where there would be a gap, and then like. Just to take that beat before you see the last line was always the best.
Yeah.
So what, you know, when people do say like, how can you talk about X or how could you say that? Like, what is your, do you have another answer besides like, well, it's comedy and don't fucking worry about it.
I mean, I took it as when I started out, I wanted to be a writer and I wanted to show, I wanted people, someone to hire me to write for them. And so I wanted to show people that I could do it. And it seemed to me harder to make a joke about these horrible, you know, like, and I literally made a list. I was like, abortion, suicide, you know, stillborns, like, death, like, the hardest things people, like, don't want to laugh about. You shouldn't joke about that. I was like, let me find a way to do it. So I would literally write, like, I would write 100 jokes. It took me years to write a joke about suicide or a joke that mentioned the word rape. And you have to find these, like, different angles in a way to make it funny. That was the challenge to me was, like, it was like scaling a mountain. To me, that I was like, if I can do this, then I can do anything. You know, that if you can write dark, you can write light. And then by the time I got the Fallon job, I was like, I only want to write dark. Like, I couldn't write anything else.
Do you think if something horrible happened really close to you, like, would you still be able to write about it, or would you feel like, I can't write about that shit?
You know, I wondered, that was my fear in the beginning, was that I would, like, you know, like Marc Maron calls it building the clown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if you, like, build your clown, and then, like, my mom died or something, and then, I like, nothing would be funny to me. And there are certain things that there's a couple, you know, things that have happened to family members or friends of mine that I probably wouldn't, that maybe makes it harder for me to do a joke about, but I definitely see it as a challenge. You know, like, a friend of mine had a miscarriage. And I was so upset for her and really bummed out. But at the same time, I was like, I had thought of 3 miscarriage jokes on the spot. And none of them were good enough. It's got to be that thing. But it makes it tougher. But I like that challenge. You know, that's one of the things that attracts it to me is making myself laugh about it.
Yeah. Life, so it helps you deal with it,
like,
too.
Helps you deal with it. Like, life goes on.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to fucking die. Everyone. Yeah. And things just keep on moving, keep on turning.
Well, that's like sort of the great comedy of life, right? We do all this stuff. And like, and in the end...
Nothing.
Yeah, end up matter. The same.
It doesn't keep you alive.
Yeah,
exactly. Then why not? I think what I do is a noble thing. I'm not trying to like upset people. I'm trying to make other people feel better. Like, I'll get hate mail sometimes about a joke or something. They'll be like, I normally like your act, but this joke about cancer crossed the line for me because of my mom.
Yeah,
and I'll say, listen, I help people. I make people laugh at the worst things the world has to offer. I'm just don't help people like you. At least not today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I don't need everyone. I'm not a people pleaser. You know?
See, I would totally backpedal. I'd be like, I'm sorry, I'll never do that joke again. I don't know what it is. I'm an emotional sponge with people. And if I'm near someone and they're feeling something, I just feel it and I can't help it. And so, you know, then I really personalize it and I'm like, oh, you're right. That would be horrible. And I, you know, fuck. Okay.
So I just don't have that kind of, you know, I mean, it's easy for me to say, like, you should laugh at everything or you should laugh at nothing. But at the same time, I do consciously back away from things that I feel like, ah, someone's going to get their feelings hurt. I mean, obviously, I can't control that every time, but within reason, I just... It's so funny, the comedy that I do now and what I did when I first started, like you said.
But why let one person affect, you know, the laughter that thousands may get from that joke? Just one person out of...
You know what?
It's like one tweet out of all the great... Like, you know, like someone says something shitty on Twitter, you focus on that as opposed to, like, everyone else going, you're the best, you're so funny.
I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
It's the same reason why, you know, like going back to the Dean Martin roast and they're making slavery jokes to to Red Fox. It's just like, well, I don't know. That's maybe not the best.
That reminds me of this one time Don Rickles ran into Frank Sinatra.
He did. He said... The joke that Dean Martin told about, like, the roast, the Red Fox thing, it didn't even make sense. It just was, the joke was, because Red Fox has white hair, that had white hair, and he says, Red Fox is here, his grandfather used to pick cotton, now he's got cotton on his head. And I didn't even understand that. I was like, well, I don't...
That's just free association. That's not even a joke.
it's slavery free association, which I didn't really... And so, yeah, I mean, like, that's, I don't know. I think that's a situation where if I knew people were bummed out about that, I wouldn't, you know, I don't tell those kinds of jokes anymore. In the beginning. Well, in the beginning, it's like when you're a young comic, if you can't get laughter, it's easier to just get a reaction out of people.
Sure.
And so you just say horrible things. Let me put it this way. I shouldn't say you, I would say horrible, shocking thing. I wrote a whole story about that I used to read on stage that was like the last chapter of a book that was about, I said, there's a book I'm working on. This is a family drama. I'm getting away from comedy. And it was a story about a boy like who just turned 18 and he was moving out of his grandmother's house. His parents had died in a car accident and she had taken care of him. He was going off to the army. So this is the last chapter. And then it turns from this sweet sort of family drama and then goes into this really disgusting romance novel and he graphically fucks his grandmother. I mean, there's no swearing in it, but it's just like, you know, she removed his turgid member from the flesh, which contained the DNA that she gave him. You know, it's just like this very descriptive. And
that's funny. That's a funny line.
No, but it went on and on and on because every time I would do it, I would add something else, and it got super long. It was like a 4-minute story, which is forever on stage when you're, you know, doing something like that. And I just wanted, and people would be like, "Oh, gee, oh," and that was the reaction I wanted. Sometimes people would laugh, but other times people were like, "That's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life."
One thing that's I think important for young comics to learn is that even when people aren't laughing, they're still being entertained. That even if people are going like, oh, no, like they're not laughing at it, but they're still having a hell of a time.
And it's a reaction, which is, you know, if anything, it's better than nothing.
But I want a laugh. I don't want just like, I want you to laugh at what I'm saying. And
you want both.
That comes from the twist.
I want laugh, but I want fun. Like, I want people to have fun at shows. Like, it's bigger. For me, it's different than just, I like when they laugh, but I also, I want everyone to feel like this is fun. I'm having fun. Yeah. You know,
I like 50-50. I like half the crowd, and hopefully that's they're mixed in, but I want half the crowd to be furious and the other half to be having the time of their lives.
Because like, it's a good laugh when you see someone stern face and then crack because the joke is so good. You know, or you just see some, and then they go, you know.
Well, plus,
that's
as a kid,
great.
Like the things I liked, if someone else didn't like them, it made me like it more. Do you know what I mean? It's
sure.
Like, it was cool to me that not everyone dug it. That I have no problem kind of going for that.
Well, that's there's a control thing in that too of basically forcing people to laugh against their will. There's definitely a control thing in that.
Yeah.
But I always, you know, I don't know. Even at shows, I'm looking around at faces and checking in and seeing how people are doing, and you know, seeing it's just sort of like dancing near a line that maybe could, you know, if they felt that I was mean, might. But they know that I'm fucking around and that it's fun, and I'm always checking around.
I always see old people, really old people, and I want to make them laugh. Like, I'll do anything to make an old person laugh at a show. It just something about it is really fun to me. Especially old ladies. If you get like a group of old ladies and they're laughing, oh, it's the best.
But a huge group of old ladies.
A huge group would be the best thing ever.
But it wasn't. That was one of the bad shows. that we had in San Jose.
Oh, those were, they were like kind of bitchy. They were, that was like bitchy Orange County women, wasn't it?
Was no, it was in San Jose, and it was literally like the show. We're out by the door taking pictures, and 30 white-haired women, just elderly women, walked out of the showroom. And then I saw that, I was like, oh, okay.
Were they in the red hat club?
Makes a lot more sense.
That was like a 7 o'clock Saturday show, wasn't it?
Were they wearing purple dresses and red hats? Were they in the red hat club?
Yes, it was 30 Helens, and they agreed that the show was not there.
I was in Austin last year, and at the end of my set, you know, I love Austin. They're great crowds and everything.
Good town.
And I, at the end, I'm like, does anyone have any requests, any jokes from like my old album that you guys would like to hear? And somebody yells out, blind! And I'm like, oh yeah, I have a joke about blind people. So I tell it and it gets a laugh. And this part of the audience is kind of like, ooh. And I'm like, what the fuck? So afterwards, I'm standing there, you know, signing autographs. And this guy comes up to me. He's like, hey, I'm the one who yelled out blind. There were like a bunch of really old blind ladies in front of me. I thought it'd be funny. And I was like, oh shit. And then right behind him are these three super old blind ladies who walk by, and they're like, that was very funny. And then the last one comes up, and she's blind as shit. Like,
blind as shit.
She looked like she had taken shrapnel or something. And she goes, excuse me, can I tell you a joke? And I'm like, yeah, please. And she goes, how many hands did it take Helen Keller to masturbate with? And I'm like, how many? She goes, two. One for her vagina and one to moan with.
And I was classic.
Like, oh, like these women loved that joke. Like that was one of my favorite audience interactions.
Well, I wonder, you know, if someone in that situation is used to people being like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, like, do they want to sort of feel like, hey, I'm normal. I'm just like everybody else. Like, let's fucking fuck around with it. You know, like, let's have, don't treat me like I'm, you know.
Yeah, don't put your kid gloves on for me.
Don't treat me like I'm disabled.
Yeah,
you know?
Like people who, like when I tell a cancer joke, it's never, people who complain are never people with cancer. It's always someone who has someone close to them and the person's never at the show. Yeah. They knew someone. People with cancer love that shit because they never get to hear it. You know, they never get to laugh about what's going on in their lives.
And you feel like that it helps them sort of, well, it just helps, like you said, it just helps people in general just deal with horrible, horrible shit.
Exactly. Exactly. That was always the biggest laugh as like a kid. It's something you shouldn't be laughing at, and you laugh at that. That's as big as it gets, I think. That's all I care about.
When how does the show reflect? Like, how do you take what you do and translate it into a television show?
You know, the show's kind of a bigger reaction to being on Jimmy Fallon, and you know, being on that show and having to pitch things. And they hated every single thing I ever pitched. I didn't get a lot of jokes on, and I just kept. Someone would just once said, you know, this would be great. This isn't good for the Jimmy Fallon show, but it would be good for the Anthony Jeselnik show. And after a year of that, I was like, let's go try to do that. So a lot of it are like bits that would be kind of late night parody things that are just have a darker twist. I mean, my sensibility is dark. And then I want to be able to do a monologue. I want to be able to talk about stories, but stories that interest me. It's almost like if I had Twitter and I had to talk about current events kind of thing, you know. So it's the show's still kind of coming together. You know, we're kind of calling it like a Daily Show meets Gawker kind of thing.
Okay.
But just with the darkest stories imaginable. Because that's the ones I feel like people like to click on, or I like to click on anyway, is when the guy murders his wife and boils the body for 4 days to try to get rid of it. Like, that's what I want to joke about.
Right. You know?
So we've got some pretty good stuff lined up, I think. But we are going to try to do a segment called Sacred Cow. We try to make fun of something that's like, you shouldn't be making fun of. And the first one we've got on planned is cancer. Where I'm going to go into like a, you know, a cancer, we have a bunch of like a kind of absurd bits. And then I'm going to go into like a cancer support group and do an act, you know, and do some like, tell some regular jokes and see what the reaction is, and then tell cancer specific jokes and see how that goes. You know, and whether it goes well or not, we're still putting it on TV. But that's interesting.
But that's funny because that can become a really brutally like mean bit. But if they laugh, it becomes the sweetest
I think
segment. Like, it becomes a very heartfelt moment.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I, you know, again, it's sort of the thing where, you know, people are going to be defensive at first, I think, because they'll go, well, if you don't have cancer, then you don't have the right to talk about that. Yeah. You know?
But if you make a joke up top, I mean, I feel totally confident about doing this bit that, that I think it's going to, it'll be interesting. That's for sure. But I, you know, I feel like I've got my philosophy and I'm sticking to it.
Well, I think people can be on board with something as long as they feel safe, in the sense that, you know, it's not like you're a douchebag in a bar who's like, fuck people with cancer. You know, like, That's not what you're saying. Mm-hmm. If people really understand that it's like, this is part of the human experience and everything, like nothing is sacred, and we have to be able to laugh at horrible things so that we can get up every morning. I mean, honestly, if you couldn't laugh at things, there's very little point to life.
Yeah.
Because it's just fucking, life can be too hard.
Oh, it's nonstop brutality. Yeah. It can be pretty terrible.
Particularly now with horrible things that are going on. It's like, oh, if you can't laugh at stuff, you would just fucking murder, you would just kill yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's too, like, there's just too much horrible sad nice relief things going laughing. On.
Yeah, now that religion doesn't work anymore, you need something.
You need something else, yeah.
You need to laugh. Like, have you ever read Rodney Dangerfield's autobiography?
No.
And me? Amazing. One of the saddest books you'll ever read. And the last line is, all I can tell you that I've learned in this life is that life is nothing but shit. Like, that's literally the last line of his autobiography. After this, like, amazing life he had, but just, you know, just couldn't have been more of a downer of a guy. Jeez. That I think that's... Now that's comedy.
Yeah, you know? That's great.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, read that book. It's amazing.
I will. Yeah. I absolutely will. I wonder if... he probably didn't record an audio version of himself. When comics write books, I like to listen to the audio version.
Yeah, Jonah, I loved Born Standing Up, and he was like, I listened to Steve Martin say it, and it's so much better that I've got it. I haven't listened to it yet.
It's great. It's his story, and to hear him, like, take the beats or like do the asides as he intended. It's like I think they're both great, you know. Yeah.
Cool. Well, so January, did you say 13th?
January 13th for the special, mm-hmm. 10 o'clock. They'll rerun the shit out of it. And then.
So when you start seeing commercials for the Golden Globes, remember.
Yeah, that. Remember that once before you get the best picture, flip over.
What's the name of the special?
Caligula.
Yeah, and the cover of it is just this fucking huge great white shark like breaching out of the water.
Yeah, I was very excited about it. You had to fight for that one because
they wanted your face on it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But I got so sick of my face on my last album that I was like, please let me do anything else. And I was psyched. The guy, have you ever watched Shark Week?
Yes, of course.
Like, I love Shark. And when they do Air Jaws, it's the best. And the guy who does those specials is a photographer. And I went on his website to like try to buy a poster. And I saw this picture of this, what I used for my album. I was like, I've got to have this. And I was like, I'm prepared to pay like X amount of dollars. I need to have this in my cover. And we called the guy. And the guy said, you can have it for free as long as you don't say anything bad about sharks on your album. And I was like, oh, I fucking love you. Oh, that's the coolest.
That's fantastic.
If you lay a finger on these gentle creatures, I swear to God, I will eat you.
Another thing about sharks.
You motherfucker! I... told you. Cool, man. Well, Anthony Jeselnik on Twitter. I'm not saying it for any reason like people should attack you, but I'm just like, people, if they want to follow you, they should go to Anthony
Jeselnik. Yeah, sure. Google Jeselnik if you get close. They'll help you out.
It's Jeselnik.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Anthony is A-R... 7.
I hear a niner in there.
I get mad when people misspell my name on things, but if they misspell Anthony, I lose my mind. Lose it.
Thanks for being here, man. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Enjoy your burrito.
Sorry, Jonah.
What?
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Every year, 50 teenage girls, one from every state, show up in Mobile, Alabama to compete in the largest cash scholarship competition exclusively for high school girls. They spend months training to win the big prize. But what happens when a Supreme Court decision leaves many of them feeling unprepared for the real world?
A lot of the girls were crying, and I never seen any of them cry before.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. I'm your host, Shima Oliai. Follow me behind the scenes as all 50 girls are catapulted into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. What do they think of their changing country? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.